Action Read Community Literacy Center is looking for new volunteer tutors. Action Read Community Literacy Center is looking for new volunteer tutors. 4 out of 10 people aged 16 to 65 struggle with reading, writing, math, and other essential skills. Many adults here in Guelph are looking for support in reading job postings, calculating budgets, applying for benefits, and participating in community life. Action Read tutors are trained to help adults work from their current skills to reach their goals in work, learning, and life. If you can spare a couple of hours a week for the next year, you can make a big difference working one-on-one with an adult learner. Action Read has a terrific suite of tools and resources, and a wealth of experience to help new tutors develop their skills teaching math, reading, writing, and computer basics. For more information or to volunteer, call 519-836-2759. That's 519-836-2759, or visit us online at actionread.com.
And welcome to this week's episode of Terra Informa. I'm your host, Rebecca Rooney, and I'll guide you through the next 30 minutes of environmental news. This week on the show, David Karchin brings us an interview with rainforest restoration expert Jim Tedder, and Steve Anderson delves into the regulatory realm of salmon farming in BC. But first, Jade Gregg brings us a review of the week's top news stories.
Thanks, Rebecca. The Calgary Herald, on September 9th, wrote about a Calgary researcher that has developed two new approaches to the controversial science of geoengineering, a tool its proponents say could one day prevent global warming, but which some environmental groups dismiss as a cover-up of political inaction. David Keith, a scientist at the University of Calgary, says the research is necessary to weigh the pros and cons of geoengineering, which, along with reducing carbon emissions, could prove a potentially important tool for managing climate risk. Keith, a director at the Institute for Sustainable Energy, Environment, and Economy, says, "We have a problem with global warming. Surely learning ways that might, at relatively low cost, reduce some of the risks from global warming is a good thing. Ignorance is not a sensible strategy. It's better to know something about this tool, both whether it works and whether it doesn't work." But some groups fear geoengineering, a theory which involves injecting chemicals into the atmosphere to reflect solar radiation and cool the planet's surface, could be used to justify political inertia when it comes to cutting emissions. "The best cure for a disease is to cure the disease rather than to cover up the symptoms," says John Bennett, executive director of Sierra Club Canada. While traditional geoengineering models mimic volcanoes by injecting sulfur dioxide gas into the upper atmosphere, Keith's theories focus on two things: quote-unquote levitating, engineered nanoparticles, and releasing sulfuric acid in a condensed vapor above the Earth. Moving along now to check in on U.S.-Canadian climate relations. The Star reported on September 10th of U.S. Speaker of the House, the Honorable Nancy Pelosi's visit from Washington to Ottawa. Pelosi, along with the Honorable Edward Markey, Chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee and Chairman of the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, were upon Canada's capital in order to meet with certain key actors in the energy and environmental sectors. Among these key actors were not only Environment Minister Jim Prentice, the premiers of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Quebec, but also environmental activists, energy industry executives, and First Nation groups. Pelosi's office reiterated that these American officials were on Canadian soil in order to listen and learn. And these prudent and humble motivations seem to have permeated their talks. Environmental Defense and the Pembina Institute came out with comments from some of those key players on September 9th. After attending the meeting in Ottawa, Dr. Marlo Reynolds of the Pembina Institute is quoted as having remarked how absolutely impressed he was with the speaker Pelosi's focus and conviction to move the U.S. toward a cleaner energy future. He added, "He only wishes we had the same, that is, focus and conviction to a cleaner energy future here in Canada." Similarly, Dr. Rick Smith of Environmental Defense was buoyed, stating that he finds it very encouraging that two such strong advocates for clean energy and action on global warming reached out to us to learn about the environmental impacts of the tar sands. And he continues saying, "Speaker Pelosi and Congressman Markey understand that America needs to chart a course off oil and is making the investments to spur that transition." Indeed, Reynolds divulged that during the meeting, they discussed how new pipelines like TransCanada's proposed Keystone XL pipeline to the U.S. risk locking the U.S. and Canada into growing dependence on high-impact oil. As the primary customer of Canada's oil sands, he continues, "Americans will rightfully question whether increasing their dependence on the oil sands advances or distracts from this clean energy agenda." In other news, the Lethbridge Herald reported September 3rd on some slippery news impeding the opening and use of a new $12.5 billion water treatment plant in southern Alberta. It was scheduled to open for service in the spring, but multiple delays, including problems with the old plant, the high turbidity of the water, and the weather, have repeatedly interrupted construction of the facility in Ridge Reservoir. The town of Raymond and New Dayton are currently under a boil water order, and have been since the advisory was urgently issued after the area was hit by heavy, repeated rainfall and cresting rivers in June. Alberta Health Services urged these communities and others near Medicine Hat not to use their tap water for drinking, cooking, washing vegetables, or brushing their teeth, unless it's been boiled rapidly for at least 1 minute. This is Jade Gregg reporting for Terra Informa. Take care. Back to you, Rebecca.
Thanks for that, Jade. If you're looking for more information on any of the environmental news stories Jade covered, check us out online at terrainforma.ca. If you want more frequent updates, you can also subscribe to our Twitter feed or find us on Facebook. For years, there has been controversy over the salmon farms dotting the coast of British Columbia. The main concern of environmentalists are what impact these farms have on wild salmon populations. Consecutive below-normal salmon returns during the spawning season have kicked those concerns into high gear in recent years. Transfer of disease from farmed salmon at high densities to migrating wild stocks, the effects of fish farm waste on the receiving environment, and the risks posed to wild fish by escaped farmed fish are just some of the issues. Salmon have been in the news quite a lot lately on account of the above-average amount of returning salmon this year. But it is too soon to say whether this is merely a blip on the radar or amounts to a reversal of the declines of recent years. This week, Steve Anderson talks to Randy Christensen, a lawyer with the environmental group EcoJustice, about the way in which monitoring of fish farms is being carried out.
Fish farms began popping up on the West Coast in the 70s, and as Rebecca mentioned, there has been no shortage of controversy over the years. Industry says that by putting farmed fish on dinner tables, they're helping take pressure off wild stocks, and that they provide a source of employment to communities in what are often fairly remote areas. But when tens of thousands of fish are kept in huge mesh cages, problems do arise. Concerns have been raised over the large volumes of fish feces released into the surrounding water, the use of antibiotics, and the potential for the farms to spread disease, particularly sea lice, to passing wild fish. In addition to this, some fish inevitably escape the farms, and there are worries that non-native species like Atlantic salmon may become established and compete with native stocks. To keep an eye on all of this, there are of course government regulations. Today, I speak with Randy Christensen, a lawyer with EcoJustice, to learn more about the regulations that are currently in place and the shortcomings he sees with them. To start off, I asked him just what sort of things the government monitors at fish farms.
Well, it's interesting because for a number of years, the monitoring has been done by the provincial government. because of a lawsuit that's happened in the past couple of years, that's now being transferred over to the federal government. And what we're seeing right now is the provincial government more or less winding down its monitoring program without the federal government being in place to take over. To answer your question, what is generally monitored by the provincial government are reports from the fish farm companies. So those would cover everything from how many fish are stocked to counts for sea lice, monitoring for disease, treatment with insecticides, which happens when there are outbreaks of, for example, sea lice, treatments with antibiotics. And what used to happen is that the fish farm companies would take samples of fish and forward those to the provincial government to do its own analysis on the farm salmon. That's something that's very recently stopped.
So is there basically no reporting happening right now, or what's happening at the moment?
What is happening right now is the forwarding of tissue samples has been refused. Fish farms are refusing to forward samples to the provincial government. And the concern about that is that many of the other aspects of fish farming are reported to the provincial government on an aggregate basis through the Salmon Farmers Association. So how it works is three to four or five farms in a region will report their own numbers, say, regarding sea lice counts, to this independent industry agency. And that agency will report back on a regional basis, but the provincial government doesn't receive the raw data in most cases. So the tissue samples and the fish samples were very important for the provincial government's monitoring purposes. So the government is still receiving some aggregated data through the BC Salmon Farmers Association, but their ability to monitor the industry has been greatly compromised.
And why did the fish farmers stop sending in those tissue samples?
Well, I'm not sure I know why they made that decision. I know that one could speculate, and sort of on the more innocuous end, you could have the salmon farmers deciding that the provincial government is no longer going to be the regulator after a few more months, and they're not bothering to cooperate with the regulator, or it could be that the testing results would show something that the fish farmers don't want to be made public. But I don't know exactly why they've taken the step. I know that from a public perspective and from an environmental perspective, it's a big concern.
It seems like kind of a sloppy handoff between the two levels of government. What's monitoring been like while the provincial government was in charge?
Yeah, most definitely. The federal government, as I mentioned, that this is the result of a court case that happened and was decided about a year and a half ago. In that court case, it was found that the fisheries is a matter of the jurisdiction of the federal government, and the provincial government's regulation was therefore unconstitutional. And the court set aside a period of time for the transfer of regulatory power over to the federal government. But this isn't something that the federal government sought out. And they're only now in the process of issuing draft regulations for the public to see. Those regulations are certainly of a concern to environmental groups and other observers. But yeah, the transition between the provincial and federal government is certainly not going smoothly.
Can you speak a bit more to the concerns you have around the federal regulations?
Yeah, there's a number of concerns, and we're primarily focused on a lack of transparency, a lack of rigorous data collection and monitoring and analysis. And we were hopeful that the federal regulation would provide stronger rights of public access to the results of testing and monitoring, and that hasn't occurred. So I think even though the level of government that's regulating the industry has changed, the public will be in no better position to know what's going on. And that's that's of concern, because while we're having a very large number of sockeye returning this year, a Fraser River sockeye, not all of the runs are in as good a shape. Not all the species of salmon are in as good a shape. And right now, this record year of salmon returns follows a year that's generally described as a crash. So while it's cause for optimism that the run seems to have recovered for this year, we need to find out why the runs year over year for 25 years have been declining, save this last year.
We've talked a bit about the problems that you see with the regulatory system as it stands. In an ideal world, what sort of system would you put in place?
Well, I think what we need to see is a system where there is a more active involvement and regulatory presence on the farm, so you would have more actual site visits by federal government officials. You would actually see testing and reporting that's publicly accessible for a larger number of potential disease threats and sea lice. Many observers, including most environmental groups, are calling for a move to what's called a closed containment system. So that may be a system that is on land, or in some cases could be done in water, but not with an open net, but with a closed system. And that would eliminate the potential risk of disease transfer or sea lice transfer from farm fish stocks to wild stocks. And there are there is at least one fish farm company that's running a pilot project for a land-based containment system. So it may be that down the road the industry moves into a type of production which is much less of concern.
So ideally, you're looking for more of a change in the way that industry does business rather than solving these problems through regulations?
That's right. But in the interim, we'd like to see better reporting and better public access to data. I should mention that much of the data that the provincial government has in its possession, it's refused to release to the public. And I've represented an environmental group, the T-Buck Suzuki Foundation, in proceedings before the Information and Privacy Commissioner. And it was a battle that took 6 years, and we were given the right to information up to a certain point in time. And the information commissioner said there's absolutely no question that this data should be made publicly available. But since then, we've run into a situation where the provincial government has subsequently refused to release the identical data for future or for a subsequent time period. So it looks like we're going to have to go back and fight that battle once again.
Why do you think it is the government is so reluctant to release that data?
That's a really good question. When we've been through the FOI proceedings, they've put forward a number of arguments and a number of suggested harms that might occur, and there were arguments put in by, you know, a number of different parties, including the group that I represented, the Salmon Farmers Association, individual salmon farms, the provincial government, and the information commissioner determined that there was no risk of any harm to the industry from the release of this data. So it's really kind of puzzling to us that the provincial government is once again refusing to release this information. Again, one can only speculate, but given that the provincial government, the industry, have fought this hard to keep it secret, it makes us wonder, you know, if this data really shows that there's quite a significant impact on the environment from these farms, because we can't think of any other reason that the companies and the provincial government would be fighting so hard.
That was lawyer Randy Christensen discussing the regulatory system that's in place to monitor fish farming. Randy works with the environmental group EcoJustice, and he spoke to us from Vancouver. Back to you, Rebecca.
Thanks, Steve. If you're just tuning in, this is Terra Informa, a weekly news program dedicated to environmental news and issues. We're now broadcast all across Canada, so you might be listening to us anywhere from Nelson, British Columbia to Windsor, Ontario, or maybe even way up in Tuktoyaktuk or at the Akati Diamond Mine. But no matter where you call home, you can listen to us at your convenience by downloading our podcast or streaming the show from terrainforma.ca. Rainforests are incredibly complex ecosystems. Once destroyed, it can take many hundreds or even thousands of years to restore what once existed. This is bad news for our lost old-growth forests. But the good news is that a surprisingly good imitation job can be achieved when innovative people put their minds to it. Today on Terra Informa, we bring you How to Grow a Rainforest. David Karchen speaks to Jim Tedder, farmer and tree grower on the Pacific East Coast of New South Wales, Australia. We find out that, with some great care and careful planting, recreated rainforests can provide many ecological benefits. David filed this report from Brisbane, Australia.
Jim Tedder, thanks very much for having us on your property here on the north coast of New South Wales, and thanks very much for joining us on the show.
A pleasure.
So we're standing here in one of your paddocks, or what used to be a paddock, but today is covered with trees of ranging from sort of 1 metre to 3 metres in height, and this is a rainforest in the making.
Well, yes, actually, I've just measured one of them. One is now 7 metres high, several of them 7 metres high. They were planted at the end of 2007, so they've had a good start, but it's hardly a rainforest in the true sense of the word because I've put in all sorts of species.
So then what exactly is a rainforest in the true sense of the word?
There's only about 2% of the original rainforest cover left since white settlers. And that consists of several kinds of rainforest. There's a cool temperate, which grows up in the 3,000 or 2,000 metre line. There's a warm temperate, which grows a little lower. And there's a subtropical, which grows further down. And up in North Queensland, there's a tropical rainforest in the true sense of the word.
So the cool temperate is perhaps the closest type of ecosystem to what we might have in Canada. So what we're seeing today, I think, is a subtropical rainforest, and that's probably quite exotic compared to the rainforest that we find on the west coast of Canada. Would that be right?
Oh, yes. There are at least 300 species of trees in a subtropical rainforest. They range from palms to various large trees and to small trees, and they're very mixed indeed.
And so what kind of rainfall do you need to have a rainforest?
Not as great as all that. If you've got a fairly regular rainforest, say up to 1,000 millimetres a year, and provided you can get the trees established without a frost, then they'll grow in many areas. They do like reasonably good soil, though.
This whole idea of growing a rainforest seems perhaps a little bit it might come as a surprise to some of our listeners. So a rainforest is an incredibly complicated ecosystem, but it turns out that we can actually recreate one from what was once just an open paddock?
Given 1,000 years, yes. What we've planted here, it's more an arboretum than a rainforest in this particular patch because I've thrown in all sorts of species. But one of the foresters said that if you log a rainforest with 80% of the canopy gone, it'll take about 200 to 300 years to re-establish the canopy. But another forest ecologist said, but that will only be of certain species. The original species will take perhaps 1,000 years to re-establish.
So we're not going to end up with the original old-growth rainforest, but we will end up with a forest ecosystem which is perhaps similar and which has, I suppose, some of the same ecological values, or I hope that we get some of those ecological values. Have you noticed any birds or animals inhabiting some of your forests that you've created that would have once lived in the original forest in this area?
Oh, yes. At the moment, because the plants here are generally only about 3 to 4 metres high, there's a lot of undergrowth, and we're getting in such things as the eastern yellow-breasted robin, and a number of small birds are moving into this area, whereas They certainly weren't here before because it was just grass. It was a paddock.
So for those who aren't used to the idea of growing a rainforest, what can you tell us about the steps that you go about in order to recreate the system? So are there certain techniques, are there certain things that foresters have learnt over the years that you've applied here?
Well, we've gone into a whole variety. We used to plant them about 4 metres apart. We'd put plastic tubes around them to shelter them until they got up. We used to dig holes that were quite deep. In some places we use a tractor to rip along lines, deep ripping, and plant in those. This particular patch here, which is the latest one, I've planted in at 2 metre intervals. And the idea in that is to get a canopy up as quickly as possible to shade out the weeds, because they do not like competition around their roots and they like to have cool root systems.
So can we go for a bit of a walk?
Yes, we'll walk over here to an area which we planted out in 1987, I think it is.
I can see already that there's a big difference between where we're standing now and where we're headed.
Oh yes, there's an area here where we decided that it was a very small patch of the paddock that we didn't want, and we decided that we'd plant it up. Well, we laid down a lot of mulch and then we put in the trees, including some from North Queensland. And these have now got to about, what do we think those are about?
They look like they must be getting near 15 or 20 metres.
Easily 20 metres.
And how did you decide which species to plant? I mean, a rainforest area, there must have been hundreds to choose from.
Yes, well, it was a case of what we could get hold of at the time. And this particular corner, trees began to reseed themselves here, so that's why we decided that we would convert this area into rainforest. See these trees here, that's a Flindersia schottiana. It's a local tree, but they were all logged out over the years. Now, the ones here on this side of the fence were planted in 1984. They are almost millable now. There are Queensland maples in there, which is a very fine cabinet timber.
So the fact that some trees are coming up by themselves suggests that the system is self-sustaining now. You've actually created a forest which is going to develop its own quirks and complexities.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, some of the acacias that were foreign, as it were, to rainforest, they grew up inside. They didn't live very long. When they fell down, they created a clearing, and with that, dozens of rainforest species have popped up in their places, completely self-sown.
Wow, it's really impressive. Some of these trees are have quite a bit of timber value, is that right? You said that some of these species are ones that were logged out originally, so I take it that you could probably sell those if you wanted to.
Oh, yes. In fact, in another part of the property, we planted 1,000 mixed rainforest trees. They will all be used for logging, perhaps in your time or your children's time or even your grandchildren's time.
Wow, we'll see what happens then. And is it an industry that is taking off? Are there lots of people who are getting into the idea of planting rainforest perhaps one day because they can sell the timber, or even just because they enjoy, growing trees for the animals and birds in the meantime?
A combination. One man, for instance, was in the process of planting 10,000 rainforest trees a year. He has quite a few hectares now, which are developing very nicely. He had a lot of money, of course, to develop this system, but there are lots and lots of people who are just using rainforest plantings to put in wind breaks and amenities, really, for their property.
Well, certainly has a lot of amenity. Jim Tedder, thanks very much for joining us on the show today. Perhaps we'll be able to come back in future years and find out just how your trees are going.
A pleasure.
Thanks, David. Well, that wraps it up for this week's show. If you have questions or comments about anything you hear on Terra Informa, look us up on Facebook or send us an email at terra@cjsr.com.